Hi, everyone. Welcome to this next episode of All In, the Sustainable Business Podcast. I'm Mark Lee, one of the regular co-hosts. Today, I'm here with just one of the fearless trio that often leads this. So Chris Coulter is here with me. Chris, welcome. Great to see you.
Hi, Mark. It's always disappointing when Dave is not here, but here we go.
I know. He sent his apologies. We are all, in all honesty, recording an all-North American episode this afternoon, and it is afternoon, so not very convenient for David in the UK, and he's begged off in lieu of, you know, sleep and taking care of himself, which seems fair. But without David, we are incredibly lucky to have Bob Eccles with us. And Bob's been on the podcast before. Many of you will remember him or perhaps know him from his many adventures in the sustainability and wider field. Bob, welcome. It's great to see you. How are you?
I'm good, and good to see you guys. I'm going to warn you that I'm going to do it now, but I've got some really important advice for your audience, but we're going to do that at the end.
Oh, okay. Can't
some advice. People need to stay on if they want the advice.
That's right. Okay. On tenterhooks. Yeah, that is clickbait, exactly. If I ever heard it. So clickbait. Terrific, absolutely. Bob. So, well, folks who know you, and otherwise we're going to let people dig up your bio online and read all the details. They'll know you as wearing many hats. But one of the things you've done recently, Bob, published a new book, and it is An American's Guide to Climate Change. And we were curious about it from several directions. And it's not the only thing we want to talk about today, but we wanted to start there. And so, you know, why this book? Why now? Why an American audience in particular, instead of making it global? Climate is everywhere and an issue everywhere. And maybe give readers a little synopsis of what's in it, and then tell us the why, if you can.
So the synopsis, and you can kind of capture the synopsis in the preface. The preface says, if you're a climate change activist, you're not going to like this book because it's not going to feel urgent enough for you. And if you're a climate change denier, you're not going to like this book because there's a chapter on the science that's quite clear about what the science is. And so you'll reject it if you don't believe in science. But those extremes represent a tiny percentage of the population in America. Mm-hmm. And so this book was written for everybody else. And when you look at these surveys, I think this was from a Pew survey. It's interesting, 89% of Democrats, something like that, are frustrated with the politicization around climate change and the political rhetoric. But so are 73% of Republicans, mm-hmm. right? So it's not just sort of a Democratic thing. Now, I think the sense of urgency may be greater on the Democratic side than the Republican side, but you know, most Republicans aren't climate change deniers. I mean, you have loud politicians, just like you have loud NGOs. And kind of how I got into this book, it really has a kind of a broader background. About 4 or 5 years ago, when the whole anti-ESG movement got started, and I started my GOP outreach campaign, and this was talking with my friends, my Republican friends, Dan Crowley, who I'd known for 20 years, Tim Doyle. We started the Responsible Business Initiative. I started to meet Republicans that were focused on climate change, and these were NGOs, the so-called eco-right. I've written about the eco-right, and I found it fascinating. There's not that many of them. They're fairly young. Maybe the oldest is 10 years old. They're fairly small. 99% of climate philanthropy goes to the left, and I found them really thoughtful people. I mean, they were concerned about climate change the same way that we would be. They know what a 2-degree world looks like, what a 3-degree world looks like. But they just were picking up the issue so differently than the kind of crowd that I hang around with. I would sort of say that on the left, it's been largely a finance-centric theory of change, which I just don't think makes a lot of sense, and we're seeing people backing off on that. Big focus on exclusions, a lot of stuff on reporting and climate transition plans. And I'm not saying those things are bad, but I don't think that they're complete. And when I was talking to these organizations in the eco-right, it's a guy named Alex Flint, who started the Alliance for Market Solutions. You've got the American Conservation Coalition, Daniel Butcher Franz, who's the CEO of that. They sort of talk about it in a different way. I mean, Alex likes a carbon tax, but you hear a lot of talk about the grid, stability in the grid. The left doesn't talk about the grid. You hear a lot about, you know, carbon capture, sequestration, and storage. You know, the left tends to kind of hate that. You hear a lot of talk about small modular reactors. You hear a lot of talk about permitting, and I think permitting needs to become more of a bipartisan thing. And so I found it, I learned a lot. And because of that, I decided, given that most people in America, and this is the reason I wrote it for Americans, because I think it's the most polarized, more polarized in America than most other places, was, okay, we're going to write a book called An American's Guide to Climate Change, How America Can Lead and Prosper. And the basic message of the book is, okay, here's climate change. It's real. It's a problem. What a great opportunity for Americans. We're smarter. We're richer. We've got bigger capital markets. We're more entrepreneurial. And look at all the great stuff going on in blue states and red states. There's a lot of great stuff going on in red states. Texas is growing wind power and battery faster than California. You've got, you know, the governor and the attorney general passing these stupid anti-ESG laws that mean nothing. So you've got this political rhetoric up here, and then you've got really tangible things going on the ground. Growth of private equity, growth of venture capital. Yeah. And so what I was looking to do in this book is establish a narrative that's more one of opportunity. It's serious. It's not this doomsday thing. If everybody doesn't become a vegan, we're all going to die. And write it in a way that most Americans would find appealing. It's a short book, seven chapters. It's 27,000 words. I wrote it for people with a decent high school education, so you didn't have to be deep into the weeds on climate. And that's what I did.
Climate for everyone. And I'll just make a comment, and I'm going to pass to Chris and let him follow up. But folks who are interested in this notion of the polarization of climate change and what folks on the right side of the political spectrum are doing about it and might do about it soon should also listen to a podcast that we just did that will be published about the same time as this one with Simon Zadek, who's talking about why he thinks that a huge part of the climate agenda is perfectly suited to a right-wing populist agenda. So if today's conversation's of interest to you, then you should listen to that one as well.
Have you done that one? That's done?
Yeah, we've already recorded it, Bob. It's just in the process of getting polished, and it will be polished about the same time that this one is when we're done with it, too.
I'd love to listen to it. That's cool.
Some good cross-pollination. But Chris, what did you hear in Bob's opening, and what do you want to follow up?
Yeah, I mean, and I think the book is fantastic, and I wanted to, you know, say Dummies for Climate Change or Dummies Guide to Climate Change, which is too pejorative, but the simplicity of
it. It's not a bad description.
But the simplicity of it and the accessibility of it, I think, is important. And this idea of the eco rate is also fascinating because it's never discussed, really. How did you find these people on the eco rate? And what's you said 10 years is sort of the tenure of these organizations. What happened before that, do you think? Was there any environmentalism from the right previous to the climate right?
I mean, if you go back, you know, 30, 40 years, this wasn't a polarized issue. I mean, you had everybody that was kind of, you know, supporting a clean environment. And then when it became climate change and the summary story I would have is that the left got the memo first. Right. En masse. And so I think they had the moral high ground for a while, but then it became a sense of moral superiority and they started to connect it to other sort of, you know, left wing issues. So then Republicans started to reject it because, you know, this was something that the Democrats were doing and it was around the just transition and big government was going to solve the problem. And so there was this kind of pushback. The eco right. You know, they're small. Most people don't know about them. I think one of the first people I met is a really brilliant guy named Eli Lehr, who started the R Street Institute, and they've got an environmental group. I met a couple of his guys, Devin Hartman and Philip Rossetti. But look, it's not hard, right? So maybe there's 10. And here I am, kind of a left of center Democrat living in Massachusetts, that, you know, likes talking to Republicans, and being left of center in Massachusetts basically makes you a Republican, even a MAGA Republican. When you sort of look at Massachusetts politics, it's probably the same mark in California. So he was kind of entertaining for these, you know, Republicans. You know, they can say that they know a Democrat, and I'm going out. And I have to boast. I mean, through the kind of GOP outreach campaign and the work that Tim Doyle and I are doing with the Responsible Business Initiative, guys, I know so many Republicans, I am introducing Republicans to each other. I kid you not. I kid you not. And so I was intrigued. And then I met a group called Deploy US, which is, you know, the woman's base kind of in the town I used to live in, Lexington, Mass. What they're doing is very interesting. It's kind of aggregating funding to try and build the field, you know, for the eco right. So you have think tanks like the Alliance for Market Solutions and C3 Solutions. You've got groups like Citizens for Responsible Energy Solutions. Heather Reams runs out. I've done an interview with her. I mentioned the American Conservation Coalition. And they're interesting because it's basically a grassroots movement. They now have over 100,000 conservative millennials in all 50 states supporting Republican candidates for office, you know, who care about climate change. And two of their most active chapters are Texas and Florida,
Wow.
where we have Greg Abbott as the governor of Texas and Ron DeSantis in Florida. I don't know why this hand doesn't go down. So, I mean, I think the work they're doing is great and it's exciting. So what I want to do is get them more visibility. You know, hopefully they get more funding. And they need to be kind of more part of the conversation because the conversation is still largely, you know, kind of a liberal-driven conversation when you read the New York Times and all that stuff.
And Bob, two things in follow-up, one small and one a bit deeper. I'll give you both of them. The small one is just, does the eco-right call itself the eco-right, or is that your label? And then the deeper one is, Chris said, 10-year history, was the right doing anything about the environment or climate change before this? And I think in your comments, you just hit on where I would have gone, is there's a deep history, especially around conservation.
Yeah,
And it
very deep.
seems to me that, whether that's the kind of Ducks Unlimited version, or whether it's the, sort of land trust version, that's always been part of what's happened
Nixon
on the
started
right,
the
and
EPA.
far from only what it was on the right. So,
And
yeah,
Teddy
can I answer the
Roosevelt and
small question and the
conservation.
big question?
Nixon passed the Clean Air Act.
But yeah, does the eco right use that label? And can you connect this for us to that conservation history? I'd be curious.
So it's funny about the label. They do, and like everything in life, some like it, some don't, you know. But if you say eco-right, everybody eco-right knows what you're talking about. A guy named Alex Bosmoski, who's at the PolUS, really coined the term. So yeah, you know, they use it. Do they kind of connect it deep into the history of kind of what it was like 30 or 40 years ago? Not so much. You know, I mean, when you look at the American Conservation Coalition, if you've got sort of millennials, I mean, they kind of weren't around when Nixon was president and things like that. So
No.
I don't know how meaningful it is. But I mean, there's a whole big theme around, you know, kind of the outdoors. I spoke at a conference in Park City called Progression, bringing kind of together sports and things. So there's actually a lot of activity, but a lot of it is still, you know, kind of not up on the radar screen. I guess another thing I should have said when I was talking about the finance-centric theory of change from the left. If you had in a soundbite to say the difference between the left and the left, it's about kind of finance, renewable energy, and we're going to sort of exclude and sort of starve capital to heavy emitting industries, which d doesn't make sense for a whole bunch of reasons we don't need to get into. On the right, it's about technology, right? So they're not anti-renewables, but it's all of the above. Geothermal, small modular reactors. Some moonshot technologies, ocean seeding, you know, sky seeding, you know, whatever, you know, sustainable aviation fuel. And there's a great guy named John Shervin. Wrote a piece with who's the CIO of Utah Retirement Systems. And when I drag him to conferences, you know, with all of my left wing buddies, and you know, he kind of goes, kind of grumps about it. But he kind of yells at him. And he asks how many people have been to an ARPA-E conference, and most of them don't know what it is. But it's really important, right? Because you've got, you know, money, and it's still even happening under Trump, where the government has a really important role of funding new technologies, you know, when they're high risk and they're not commercial. So, you know, the government can put in the capital to grow these industries. And I think China's done this brilliantly with, you know, with renewables. But then once the technology is proven, you know, then you can kind of take it to commercial enterprises and get it to scale. And one of the things about the eco-right that's interesting, and this is where you don't have a real consensus, but look, I think disclosure is important. You know my background, sadly, blah, 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 all that. But I think people expect too much from disclosure, and we can get into that, the double materiality stuff. So if I could pick one thing, it would be a carbon tax, right? It would be a carbon tax. And Alex Flint, Alliance for Market Solutions, I wrote a piece. I'm not going to tell you the guy's name because I want to protect the innocent. One of the people that I met in EcoRight, I'm having lunch with him one day. It was coffee, really, in DC. And he goes, "I think there's going to be a carbon tax one day." I go, "Is that right?" He says, "Yeah, look at it this way. Carbon emissions are going up. Federal debt is going up. You know, government's going to need to raise money." I said, S "You know, slam dunk now. Why don't you write this up?" He says, "Well, it's a little complicated for me, you know." And I said, "I'll write it up." So I'm basically ghosting for this guy, right? And I wrote this piece in Real Clear Energy. And he sent me a lot of good material called, carbon emissions, US carbon emissions and federal debt make create the perfect storm for carbon tax with a guy named Tim Yeomans. We've written kind of a very detailed paper on how you could have a policy. And so I think it's going to happen. People think I'm crazy, but I think it's going to happen. And if we could shift the conversation and start talking more about how to put a price on carbon, ExxonMobil supports a price on carbon. American Petroleum Institute supports a price on carbon. My friends go, oh, they just say that because they think it's going to never happen. I said, well, that's the wrong attitude, children. You go to them and you say, boys, so pleased that you support a price on carbon. We can work together to sort of make this happen. So more focus on technology, I think putting this more back into the role of the public sector. And my eco-right friends, they aren't thrilled with what Trump is doing. Okay. I mean, some of the stuff is as nutty, his thing closed down, we're going to pay you to not build these windmills. Makes as much sense as Biden at, stopping exports of liquid natural gas, right? This is all sort of political theater. What everybody needs to recognize is that there's political cycles. And so you need bipartisan policies. And this is where we're screwed, right? Where China's, done well. If it keeps going back and forth between Democrats and Republicans, Trump unravels what Biden did. We get a Democratic president that'll unravel what Trump did. It's hard for companies that are investing capital, the oil and gas companies that need to sort of plan, you're trying to do stuff in hydrogen. So one of the things that I'd hoped to do in this book was, and again, it's just one book and there's other people doing other good work. But if we could kind of say, look, let's quit the bickering, ignore the extremes. Let's all come together, see it's an important, critical issue, but it's also a great challenge, and come up with a bipartisan approach. And it's just this simple little thing. People need to learn to listen to each other that they don't necessarily agree with. Look, I've talked to a lot of Republicans. I'm not dead. I'm still alive. It's been fun.
That you survived them and they survived you,
We both
importantly.
survived each
It's
other, so it's all good. It's all good.
And what about the people part of this? Because I think one of your chapters was focused on adaptation. And what are your thoughts? Because I recall one of our former chairman, a Lord Home, call me Richard Home, was an early thinker on sustainable business. This is many years ago, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago. He thought adaptation, like it's a jobs agenda. It's exactly what we should be focusing on together with mitigation. You'd build consensus. People like to build stuff and let's do that. And that, I mean, what's your sense of the role adaptation should play going forward and how we talk about this?
It's a good question. And I think they should both be equal and they're related to each other, as I talk about in the chapter on mitigation adaptation. I mean, I've got good friends, smart friends. 10 years ago, if you said adaptation, they kind of got the hives. It was like, you can't talk about that. It's going to, reduce the sense of urgency on mitigation. And the fact of the matter is, we're past 1.5. We might as well admit it, and kind of quit hanging on to something that's an illusion. And you're going to need to have both, because if you kind of kept carbon emissions flat today or even declining, you look at the science, things are going to keep heating up, and you're going to have more extreme weather events. That's a big part of my book, is talking about extreme weather. So Trump goes, okay, there's a lot of snow, so what's about climate change? I think another important thing people to understand is that, yeah, there's kind of global warming. So, on average, maybe well, not maybe, it is getting warmer. But what it's doing is it's making weather more extreme. So when it's really hot, it's really hot. And when it's really cold, it's really cold. And when it rains, it really rains. And when it snows, it really snows. And, that just cries out for adaptation. And you look at the vulnerable areas. I live in New England. We're kind of good when you sort of look at projections 30, 40 years from now. Louisiana, Texas, Midwest, they're dealing with it now. Florida. So I think kind of the physical reality is going to come to bite pretty soon, where you can't get insurance. Florida's got, kind of state insurance plans, and they'll go bankrupt. In the end, I think kind of the physical reality and the economics, will dominate.
Yeah, I think just to comment, that the impacts are now, we need adaptation now. I agree. I'm in that world. And then, Bob, you talk in the book, I think, about, the combination of prosperity and pragmatism and natural interest. And is this, in essence, why that all comes together? That we that we have to deal with the impacts which are hurting people in the economy now. And there's an opportunity side of this to leading the way on the technologies and the way forward. But you can take what I've said or build otherwise on what prosperity, pragmatism, and national interests mean. And for the folks who won't read the book, you know, what they get from that part of the message.
Why should I tell people that won't read the book was in the book? I mean,
that's
what kind of incentive is that for me?
Yeah,
go read the book.
So frame it in a way that makes them just not
they want to
able
read the book.
To resist yeah. reading the book. That's
the trailer.
People who haven't read the book yet, Bob.
All right. That's a much better framing. That's a much better framing.
Yeah.
So look, it's a good question. And I think, you know, there's a lot of discussion in my book about jobs and how much these jobs pay. And again, it comes to, you know, you've got to learn to kind of talk to people and see things differently than you do. The left likes to talk about a just transition. And it tends to have a more global focus. And, you know, and I respect that because it's the developing countries in the global south that's going to get hammered by this a lot more than, you know, places like Canada and North America. But, you know, a just transition is really important for a whole bunch of Republicans living in red states. And, you know, they drive pickup trucks and they eat a lot of meat. And they're probably not going to change what they drive. They can't afford an electric vehicle and they're not going to become vegan. So it's like, get over it, right? You know, if you believe in a just transition, you've got to think about those people too. And then permitting is a really important thing. So you've got the people that say we need to have renewable energy. Then you've got another environmental group protesting, you know, being able to get the transmission or distribution lines. We've got 2,700, you know, gigawatts of power that can't get into the grid because you don't have the permitting, right? So there's going to be trade-offs. There's going to be compromises. And I think being a little bit more kind of just sounds corny, concerned about your fellow citizen, even if they live in a different place and they have different politics. I mean, it's the only way we're going to solve this. And as you said, I wrote this book specifically for Americans.
Yeah.
Right. Specifically for Americans, mm-hmm. because that's the audience that I need to get to.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because they're in silos now.
Yeah, the technology side of things, I think back to some of the solutions and some of our public opinion polling around the world, especially in the U.S., but especially in the global south, a real sense that technology is the solution and an optimism, actually, that technology will help with the energy transition. And I guess that's, is that destiny? Like we are, is it a fait accompli that we will find these technological solutions, do you think? You know, AI causes problems on energy inputs and requirements, but all the, you know, the potential related to it. Like, what's the and I think you referenced carbon sequestration too and carbon capture of these is relatively unproven. And depending who you speak to, I mean, I don't know, but sometimes you talk to a geologist or an engineer, like, oh, this totally works, and someone else says, ah, it's garbage, it'll never work in the future. I mean, how do we understand without being, you know, holding on to something that's maybe not real versus we could be properly optimistic about this?
I mean, I would be optimistic. There's private equity, as you know. Private equity is sort of, you've got KKR that's got their climate fund. So you've got other, and I think Carlyle does too. So sort of at the more advanced stages, technologies, we talked about ARPA-E. I've been learning more. I don't know the venture capital community as well. I talked to some people the other day that are a fund of funds that have something like 300 portfolio companies. And when I was at this thing in Park City, so, you know, there's some really fascinating things going on. Most of these things aren't going to work. I mean, that's just the nature of venture capital. But that's kind of the part of American entrepreneurship and innovation. And when you hear people, so when I post things on carbon sequestration and storage, I get the usual hate mail. You know, Bob, you're an asshole. You know, this is just to keep the oil companies going. It's like, whatever, man. And then people say, well, it's just too expensive. And so anyway, I'm like, wait, they said that about solar. They said that about wind. It was too expensive. So you have more, you go down the learning curve, it gets better. So why can't that happen with carbon sequestration and storage? I mean, I know companies that have invested a lot of money in this. Why can't that same thing happen with geothermal? Why can't that same thing happen with small modular reactors where the technology is pretty well established? And I think you're starting to see some kind of opening up, you know, on the left in terms of, yep, I mean, I'm all for renewable energy, but, you know, having others and having natural gas as a transition, particularly for AI data centers, I think that's, potentially another place where you could get some more bipartisan consensus and quit hating on the oil companies. I mean, the whole thing about oil companies is complicated. 100 million barrels of oil are made every day. You look at the IEA projections, you look at population growth, you look at people trying to improve their living standards in developing countries. We may be producing, 100 million barrels of oil a day. That's sort of the best guess in 2050. It will be a much smaller percentage, right, of the total energy mix. How much, I don't know. But it's not, I mean, this whole thing of beating up on the oil and gas industry and we're going to sue them and this and that, and that's kind of some of the problem. It may feel good, but it's just not effective.
I wanted to go back, Bob, to a carbon tax and your confidence about it coming. And I wondered how soon you can really imagine it, because it makes sense that it would be so powerful. There's been a strong view that that's true for a long time, and we keep not getting it over the line. So do you see the conditions changing now to make that a near term thing, or are we still pretty far out?
Man, if I could answer that, I'd be a billionaire because I could see the
Yeah.
future and I'd be sort of investing money and stuff. My sense is it'll happen when there's a big crisis. Social Security goes bankrupt. The interest on the federal debt becomes just unwieldy. It will take something severe like that, where you kind of need to find other sources of revenue. And then I think people are going to go, well, okay, maybe this, carbon tax or some kind of price on carbon, is a good idea.
I mean, I wondered a little bit if the financial conditions at a national level are becoming more favorable to it. We're for listeners, they won't know exactly when we recorded, but we're recording in early May, and last week was the week in which the U.S. debt became larger than the economy for the first time since World War
Okay.
II.
That's a pretty
And
scary
so the
indicator.
scale of the debt, is at this symbolically massive point. And of course, when you go from 99% to 100%, nothing magically changes in the moment, but it is gripping. And it begs what you were talking about. Like, there have to be revenue solutions to this, not just cut solutions to this. And
There's one other
carbon
thing
tax could
that's not worth
fit.
mentioning. So there's a group called Carbon Measures. Have you heard of Carbon Measures? Do you know about them?
Heard of, I don't know well. Yeah.
So I mean, it's kind of complicated history because ExxonMobil was one of the companies that helped start it. So people go, it's an ExxonMobil, kind of spin thing. It's not true. The woman who is the CEO is named Amy Braccio. I did an interview with her. I think she's terrific. And their idea is, pretty straightforward one. And you've got people like Carter Gromino, who's at Oxford now, Bob Kaplan, who's emeritus at Harvard, and a bunch of other people, a guy named Stefan Reichelstein, who's an accounting professor at Stanford, this guy named Uwe Klackruth, who's economist at Deutsche Bank, a guy named Carl Richter, who's got a software company. The basic idea is product-level carbon accounting, right? So you've got the greenhouse gas protocol, which is kind of where the company is, unit of analysis. And what Carbon Measures is about is product level carbon accounting. And their theory of change is that if you can measure the carbon intensity of a product, which you need, carbon accounting at a product level, then you can set standards for carbon intensity. And that happened with sulfur. And so you can see how it ties into things like, CBAM. So if you get this and they're focusing on the 10 or 11 highest emitting industries, and they've got 25 or 30, members now, they were only started in October. So there's levers we have, right? There's a carbon tax. There's having carbon intensity standards for particular products, which then gives companies an incentive. So the government sets the standards and you have to meet them. So that creates an incentive for companies to innovate, to be able to do it. It enables them to grow market share. So that's another initiative that's fairly new. And there's the usual stuff about all the different, reporting standards and this and that and how they go together. And it'll always be messy, but it'll sort out. So I think that's another kind of tool in the toolbox that I'm pretty encouraged about.
Yeah, and I
Maybe
think
a
just from our,
catalyst.
yeah, from
Yeah.
our global polling, I think last time we asked it was 2024, but it was 58% supported a carbon tax worldwide versus 42% that were against it. So it wasn't, it's not a, it's, you know, it's not a terrible
Oh, that's interesting.
framing. And I think the the support really depends upon how it's used, of course. And I think you're right on the public coffers, like the EPR legislation and fines that are taking place across many states around extended producer responsibility is not driven because of an intense support for circularity or recycling. It's just that there's a way to great to help support budgets, right, at the
Droid gets
municipal
money.
levels, or yeah.
Yeah, Droid gets money. Interesting.
Bob, maybe switching gears a little bit, and you mentioned earlier that we probably asked Disclosure to do too much. And coming in today, I'd wanted to ask you just your views on the current state of the disclosure agenda, if we can call it that. And asking for folks who don't know, because of your deep involvement in ISSB and in setting standards for sustainability disclosures generally and climate disclosures in particular. We're also in, of course, a regulatory moment where, depending on the jurisdiction, climate-related disclosures are running in opposite directions, leaving companies in kind of a terrible place if they operate in each of those jurisdictions. Is this a good moment in any way for the disclosure agenda? Should we see some silver lining in there? Or is it just a period that the disclosure agenda needs to get through and get to a next stage?
If you look at the history of financial accounting, which is more straightforward, there's double entry bookkeeping, there's a theory behind it. You could say there's never a good moment. There's never a good moment, right? It's always a highly contested, what the standards are is highly contested. What companies should be required to disclose are highly contested. Bob Herz is a good friend of mine, was the chairman of FASB for two terms. He would get death threats, literally death threats, over some kind of accounting standard, with a woman named Casby Sunawal at Oxford. I've written a little series on it. For years and years and years, we had country gap. And then we got to basically, international financial reporting standards. And the French didn't like that because they thought they should be in charge of it. And then you have the NOAC agreement where you're trying to get, US GAAP through FASB and international financial reporting standards through the ISB to come together. And political things happened there and it didn't happen. And the standards kind of go back and forth. I was talking to Kartik Ramana this morning. The whole debate around, book versus fair value accounting. So it's always a complicated domain, right? So if we look at where we're at now, I think we should be pretty optimistic given sort of how long these things take. I mean, ISSB is what, 3 or 4 years old? So, they've issued, their two standards. You had the CSRD that was passed in Europe. They went way overboard, in my view, with, 2,000 data points or whatever it was. There was kind of a whole bunch of politics behind all this. The new chair of the Sustainability Reporting Board for EFRAG, the European Financial Reporting and Accounting Group, is a professor named Kirsten Lopatta, who's a good friend of mine, who's a professor at Hamburg. And she's got very good relationships with people at the ISSB. And, before we started our interview, there's been some discussion around Europe adopting for the kind of singular financial materiality ISSB standards. I think the line of sight on this conceptually is pretty straightforward. You already have between Europe and the ISSB the same definition of financial materiality. So if we run with that and then kind of put aside whether there's a legislation or regulation that's going to require the disclosure, because you're not going to get that in the United States ever. But as you were talking about earlier, companies operate on a global basis, investors are going to want it. You're going to see voluntary uptake, especially by the big companies. So what they want is essentially kind of tell us what the rules of the game are. And if you could get the EU with the ISSB to agree upon, okay, for the financial materiality, we're going to go with the ISSB. What the SRB does, it's in addition to the ISSB, is the so-called impact materiality. So not to get too down in the weeds for the listeners, but financial materiality, these are the things that affect value creation. The kind of outside and impact materiality. These are the externalities that companies are creating through their operations, and every company does positive and negative externalities. Impact materiality, that's really how GRI was formed. It's important, right? Kind of what are these externalities? Now, simply making companies report on them, this is where people expect too much from reporting, isn't going to kind of make the problem go away because there's trade-offs between financial performance and even the different sustainability issues. But I think if we had, with ISSB and the SRB, common definition and a set of standards for financial materiality, have the SRB carry the ball for impact materiality standards, use the same sector classification system that the ISB uses, which is basically adapted SASB for a while under the previous guy. You know, they were talking about their own classification system. I think that this could happen. I mean, it's just, there's a separate problem from our company's going to be required by regulation or legislation to report. But, you know, the political pendulum has swung. It's clearly swung a lot in the United States. It's swung in Europe, and there's the omnibus bill. Mm-hmm. And I think Europe just went too far with the CSDDD and what they were trying to do, the CSRD. I think the kind of the Green Deal was well-intentioned. Like, it's silly in a lot of ways. The taxonomy is bullshit. Nobody ever thought that made any sense whatsoever. So I think what we're getting to is a much more, taking a turn from our discussion about climate, a much more realistic and pragmatic view of what these standards could be and, you know, how much companies should be asked to report, distinguish between the financial and the impact materiality, distinguish between value and values. Will it always be raucous? Sure. Will people always be upset? Sure. I mean, the joke I like to tell is when a standard is finally set, guess who's happy?
No one.
Nobody. Because it wasn't their idea. Everybody was sure that their idea was the best one. It's like, no, children, it was a compromise. And so everybody's pissed off.
Yeah,
everybody's unhappy. There we go.
And because you're so deep into AI, and you've been playing with it and getting, you know, really exploring the limits and what works. How do you see disclosure in AI and disclosure and reporting evolving as well? I mean, is all of this necessary? Will it's just the robots go and uncover these things anyway? And
you know, that's like a whole conversation. I think that, you know, AI is going to make it possible to. You can kind of scrape the web and all that. That's been going on before AI.
Yeah.
I think the more interesting application of AI, and this is something that's actually in a book I'm doing with Shiva, is that it's going to enable people to do, you know, much deeper analysis, much faster with the information that they've got. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in this book, and I won't get into the details on auditability, but in the end, you need the kind of human certification. You know, if there's a standard and there's reporting on a standard, what makes something socially legitimate is going to be a human sign-off, not AI. Now, do I think we should be thinking about, and this is really an idea of Shiva, should we think about what the standards are and what we're reporting on differently in an AI world? That's an interesting question because people aren't reading 10Ks anymore. You know, the machines are reading the 10Ks. And so if we think about who's consuming the data and if this is being consumed through AI tools, we should probably think about how these tools are being used for producing the data that these AI tools are consuming. So, I mean, I think it's an important domain to look into.
There we go. So it sounds like, as you said, we could have a whole and separate conversation on AI and the various things that it is doing and might do. I'm conscious of time a bit, Bob, and I'm remembering two things. One, you said at the start of the conversation, but at the end of it, you would have advice for our listeners. And I think we got to make sure we leave time for that. And then the second is you told Chris and I before we started recording that you wanted the opportunity to share your t-shirt and its message with our listeners. So I wonder if we can do both of those things in the time remaining.
Well, they're the same thing.
Oh, okay. Didn't realize that, but here we go.
No, so we've got plenty of time. So the advice is on my t-shirt that I was wearing when I got back from the gym. And I think it's important for your listeners to pay careful attention to what I'm going to tell them on my t-shirt. And hopefully, tell me if you can read this.
Yeah, and given some of our listeners will be audio only and some will be video. For those of you who are audio only, Bob's t-shirt says school is important, but muscles are importanter.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Very important to remember.
Yeah.
That's why I flip tires and lift weights and stuff, as you guys know about. I mean,
there are other hobbies, Bob, out there. There's things like Sudoku, crosswords. You don't have
to. Yeah, that's for old people. I'm only 74, man.
Before we do let you go, what was your origin story on the sustainability conversation? Like, how did you get into the, was it all through disclosure early on? Like, where were you?
You know, it was really through disclosure. I mean, I've been doing this before, you know, a lot of people were born now. I wrote a paper called The Performance Measurement Manifesto. It was published in 1992 or 93 in the Harvard Business Review. It was basically about disclosure, and then I did some research, and then SASB was formed. And I remember, and I was one of the people that was, one of the early people in integrated reporting. And I remember talking to companies, and they go, "Hey, Bob, if I publish an integrated report, will my stock price go up?" And I think that's the stupidest question I've ever heard in my life, right? If I publish my financial statements, will my stock price go up? I don't know. It's shitty financial performance. It's probably not. And this was kind of, the whole thing, the idea of genes really behind SASB. So the transparency is important, but it's really about performance. So, and I kind of got from, okay, here's reporting, but then what are the things, and this is the work I did with George Serafeim, when I was back at Harvard Business School, what are the things companies need to do so that their performance is good on the material sustainability issues? We haven't really talked as much about materiality as we should. So, okay, here's what generates good performance on sustainability that relates to financial performance. And we don't have time for me to tell you about my book with Shiva, so do a podcast with Shiva. And then it was like, okay, so I've got all these relationships in the financial community because of a bunch of reasons. And then, what is it that the financial community wants? The asset owners and the asset managers. So it really kind of started out with disclosure, but then it was like, how are companies thinking about the relationship between sustainability and financial performance? And how are investors thinking about it? And then what does that mean for what the disclosures are? But the disclosure is just the first step, really, for decision making. They're not an end in of, in sort of an end in and of themselves.
Fantastic.
Like the personal biopic at the end of all this, if we tried to tie the disclosure and the tire flipping, might be something like from disclosures to deadlift, or I don't know. But
Yeah,
there's
good.
something for us to work on there, Bob.
Although that's
Well, yeah.
depressing, when you bring up the deadlift. So I think you guys know my personal record was 410, but
Yeah.
that's like 5 years ago, man. So I've like flatlined at 350 pounds. So that's kind of a bummer.
What was the
It's
other
a
phrase?
remarkable number.
If the world's gonna be transparent, you better be buff. Is that the other?
I'm trying. Although I don't want to be buff. I don't care if I look good in terms of muscles. I want to look like Eddie Hall. Your listeners should all go Google Eddie Hall, world record deadlift. First man to deadlift 500 kilograms, 1,100 pounds. Guy's a beast, man. He's got this mohawk haircut and he's got a lot of ink, so I'm proud of that. He's got this big gut. And that's who I want to be when I grow up.
And he
Excellent.
is
Eddie Hall. He's
inhumanly
my hero.
strong.
He's my hero, man.
Yeah, he's remarkable. Well, Bob, you're our hero. We really appreciate you
Hero.
coming on, speaking with us today. As we said to listeners at the start, it's not the first time we've had you as a guest. I hope very much it won't be the last. For all of you who've listened through the episode, whether you found us on Spotify or YouTube or Apple or anywhere in between, if you have comments or feedback on where the podcast should go from here, we would love to hear it. But I think for today, we're at that stage of Bob. Just deep thanks for your time, for your insight as always. And we wish you the best in all of your endeavors as this year moves forward.
My
Bye for
pleasure. Good
now.
talking to you guys, as always. Take
Thank you,
care.
Bob. Yeah, you take
Great,
care.
great.
Cheers. Bye-bye.